some fiscal years we're going to use more money. But we were always under, you might say, a constraint from the headquarters level. We would have an idea of what the market would bear, and we would tailor our programs accordingly. Yeah. I remember one fiscal year we really got in a bind, and back in those days we would program and get approval for something maybe like a 5-quarter year, you know, we would have enough money to take us over into through August, for example, the first month of the new fiscal year. And one time we got in the bind, and in order to reduce the budget to stay at the headquarters level, we just simply lopped off the month of August from our program operating plan and reduced our budget, you know, by 1/12, you might say.
No impact,
in other words. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of ways to skin a cat.
The one thing that struck me in, you know, analyzing the approach to management was the working groups. Now, they originated with the Saturn Systems Office, isn't that correct?
Yeah. Is that correct?
That rings a bell, Jim, but I was not personally involved in it. It seemed like there was a lot of people at the Saturn Office chaired those.
Yeah, the working group
deputy chaired them. Didn't they have some arrangement where it was the lab guy and the Saturn?
Yeah, the working groups did start. Now, where it originated, the idea originated in the Saturn Systems Office or not, I don't remember. But it did start in those days, and we had, like, internal working groups, not only internal working groups, but about the same time we established working groups with Houston, the Manned Space Flight Center.
Yeah.
I don't recall really what these working groups were, but they came into being about 1962 or 63.
So at least that early, you were trying to interface with Houston in terms of the payload problem, et cetera.
But as the program evolved, you know, like from, you know, the early 60s on up through the mid 60s and on, the program was evolving and growing all the time. I think the Saturn Systems Office was a way to start it. It was a successful management group. But, you know, as the program got bigger and become more directly involved in Houston, I think going to the industrial operations concept in 1963 was in order. But I guess as the program got bigger and the launches and we started, you know, putting men on the moon, all of this tended to formalize things to more of an extent than we experienced in the early days.
And that tends to slow you down?
That tends to slow you down because as you become more bureaucratic, that's one of the good things.
Weren't there a lot of telephone calls between guys that said, okay, we'll do this, and I'll follow up with the documentation next week?
Yeah, there was a lot of that.
That was the only way to get around it then. So the program still moved ahead.
Well, in the early days, we could commit on the telephone like that, and we could indeed follow up with a communications correspondence. And today, I'm not real sure you can do that.
But when you get so many channels, set up, you're really just on whether you can or not.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I can
too many people will approve it to know whether they're all going to get up on the right side of the bed that day.
So were you in ABMA before? You were okay. If you can remember going back to about 1958, was the ABMA group really working on a kind of a Saturn One idea when the ARPA order came, or did the ARPA order spark this as a brand new concept?
No, I think with some people at ABMA were thinking of a big booster, prior to the ARPA order, and I don't recall the point in time. At one time, we called it the Big B, 1905, whatever. There was a mountaintop program.
If we go back to 1956, we got some some inches.
But I recall planning and what have you on big launch vehicles before the ARPA order. Like, I don't know what, Juno 5, you remember Juno 5?
Okay, neither. Was that a single tank concept, or were you thinking about the multiple tanks?
Single tank.
Okay, so the multiple tanks didn't come in until after the ARPA order then.
Right.
Okay.
Well, you know, again, time gets hazy, but.
Well, I know this.
Remember the multiple tanks with those Bridgestones and that Jupiter?
Well, Dick Kenwright, who was in headquarters at that time, was at ARPA, as a matter of fact, had a lot to do with the clustered tank concept. It was a convenient concept all around because one of the selling points was that we could use Redstone Jupiter tooling, you know, the Redstone tanks and the engines and so forth. And we could proceed, you know, with the state of the art.
Yeah, the S3D engine. I think so, yeah.
But one of the selling points was we'd use existing Redstone Jupiter tooling in the cluster tank concept.
Right.
I would imagine if you're trying to give credit to anybody, for the cluster tank concept, it would probably be Dick Kenwright, who was an ARPA that time later on.
Is he still at headquarters?
He's in Pennsylvania someplace now.
I remember telling Jim a while back, I saw him on television, on why he's quit his ship.
But
he went to Douglas, and then he left Douglas.
There was a number of reasons for the cluster tank concept. One of them being, of course, we could use existing tooling facilities and what have you. And two was the common bulkhead problem at that time. You know, it would have been a real advancement in the state of the art. Mm-hmm. And the materials there, especially the insulation, that was a real common bulkhead route.
Didn't the Atlas have a common bulkhead?
Well, yeah, but they had, there was envisioned a sloshing problem.
Because the tanks are so big.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
That used to be a great concern back in the early days.
Still had to put slosh baffles in the S1, as I recall, in addition to having later on. But something else I said, too, that is in this early period is that when the order from ARPA came down, it was just to kind of do a static test to prove the feasibility.
Yes, I recall it.
So it was designed for just static tests only, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I recall it was a $3 or $4 million order. $4 million, I'm not sure, to demonstrate the cluster tank concept, 1.5 million pounds thrust. I know it was later amended to 10 million and then to 16 million, but that first order was either 3 or 4 million. 4 million, and for that we were going to design and build a first stage, you might say, an S1 stage, and modify the Jupiter test facility over here.
But then after you got into building and actually cutting hardware, it came down, let's fly the thing instead. So actually you were flying a thing that you hadn't really designed to fly in the first place.
Well, we probably always had in mind flying it eventually.
There wasn't that much difference, really. Well, actually, those tanks were all basically fly hardware anyhow. It wasn't that much of a changeover, maybe.
Well, they... Yeah, but the clustered concept was new. Well, it wasn't new, but for something this size, it was new. I guess they had test flown from Nike Hercules. That's a cluster of four solid rocket motors.
How does the Saturn cluster concept compare in historical breakthroughs to the Russians, who were already using clustered vehicles to launch their stuff?
Well, country was very limited. You know, they, you know, I just point out the Nike Hercules, and that was a cluster of four solid rockets. Of course, you know, not man-rated, which makes a difference. I think the cluster concept was, it was more of an engineering, just a straight engineering problem than it was a design problem. You had to allow for, you know, the expansion of the tank under extreme temperatures. And you thrust takeoff points and things like that. It was a complex engineering problem. I'd say more than a design problem.
I hate to keep skipping back and forth. There are several questions, you know, that I'm thinking of here. I'm kind of attacking them one by one. After the reorganization in 63, were you involved still in one of the program offices somewhere, or where did you go after that?
No, yeah, I went up as an assistant to Dr. Reeves after the 1963 reorganization.
Mm-hmm.
And the job I have presently became open in late 63, early 64. And I asked for the job and was assigned to it.
Mm-hmm. How would you comment on Reese's association with Von Braun? How did they work? That's something that has never really seemed to me come out, and I really don't have a handle on it.
Well, I essentially worked for Reese all those years in the Saturn program. I worked very closely with him. If you generalize, you could say that Reese was the in-house operator and Von Braun was the outhouse operator. And if you wanted to, you know, just get very general about it.
Yeah.
Of course, Von Braun got deeply involved in the in-house operations too, but he relied heavily on Reese in the in-house operations. But Reese knew when to make decisions and when to let Von Braun make them. Reese seemed to have made the most decisions at that time in the total program operations, you know, like budgets and facilities and the requirements they ran. Von Braun was concentrating on the concept and the philosophies of space operations.
Was Reese kind of Von Braun's troubleshooter too at
yeah.
the time?
Yeah.
He did a lot of traveling out to the contractors when they had problems. I heard him described as Von Braun's hatchet man.
Well, I think troubleshooter probably is a better word for it.
Yeah. But he carried a lot of authority then when he made these little parades to contractors,
yeah.
usually to deliver a specific message or something else.
Yeah. In those days, as you recall, well, I don't know where you recall that, those days, back in the late 50s, early 60s, Von Braun was spending a lot of time in Washington and other places, Congress, promoting space travel. And Reese was at home running the shop, so to speak.
Yeah. When the switch came from AVMA to Marshall Space Flight Center, Von Braun team as such had really operated as a research and development group at a lower scale, kind of in the organizational structure. And all of a sudden they found themselves, you know, managing an entire center. Were there any serious problems or, you know, difficulties during this period? Did they slip right into it nicely and take over, or did they have some problems of adjustment to this kind of overall concept now?
Well, there were some problems in adjusting to the fact that we were now an agency, I mean a center, a field center of a new agency. But we had some people in Von Braun's organization, though, that kind of the adhesive that kept things together, and one of them was George Constant. I think Reese had a lot to do with it.
There's one thing you must remember there, too. There was from 1945 to 60, 15 years that Von Braun had completely relied on
did they get the expertise for that then?
Well, again, they had it. They were with AB and they loved the Army. People that weren't in DOD went to
Naval. Okay. Yeah. Was Harry Gorman one of those?
No, Harry Gorman came in
later. He
came in from the
82nd deputy we had.
Yeah.
We had,
he came in as an assistant to Del Morris, who was one of our two deputies at that time. Well, there were a lot of problems when we became a field center rather than a division of ABMA. And it was many of us that had been in ABMA, what have you, had ideas about how we would like to see things go. And it was a wonderful opportunity to,
you know, by the same
to make them go, you know.
Yeah. By the same token, when we went to NASA, and it was NASA here, NASA headquarters, and president, so to speak, you know. Where in the Army, you get all the change of command.
Yeah.
You got out from under one.
And we had some real good people in NASA headquarters, like Bill Lilly, that we, you know, counseled with, and he gave us all sorts of good directions. I spoke some time ago about this fellow Jack Young that came down, and I spent about 6 weeks with him in the program operating procedures.
Is he a colonel?
No.
It was a different young.
But he became one of the top men at NASA shortly after he made the study. And most of the things that we recommended here, that I recommended was made a part of procedure within NASA. So the fact that we recommended them and they were reviewed here at the center, I know all my stuff was reviewed on a daily basis almost with Reese. And the fact that we had a major part to play in the total operating procedures as we know them today, the adjustment for us would probably make it a hell of a lot easier.
NASA wasn't all that old. They started in 58.
Yeah, and
so they were just 2 years old. So. And it wasn't a big bureaucratic conglomeration yet.
Mm-hmm. Right.
What about the tenure that Bob Young spent here? Is there any way to characterize that? Were they just kind of waiting until O'Connor took over to really get a hold of it, or did he really get it cranked up and down the road?
I don't know.
He was a different personality than we were used to, right? Yeah.
Yeah,
I think different. He's, you know, rough, and people didn't know what to make of this guy coming in from an industry on a temporary basis who went home to California every weekend and all that kind of thing. I think there was a little mystique about him. Again, this is hindsight.
Yeah.
But after a while, sort of got ineffective.
I think under the new organization, 1963, Industrial Operations, we call it, when Bob Young came in, I think the program kept going based on the old Saturn Systems Office concept. Mostly the same people.
Yeah.
Others added, of course, but your main operators were essentially the same people. Just kept operating the headquarters.
Well, then, you may recall, but before we went into IO, the Saturn had already broken up into stages.
Yeah.
Or, you know, programs within the Saturn, like Mr. Monk, Saturn,
right,
1B,
right,
and Grandwood on Saturn 5. So the whole nucleus. You know, the biggest portion of IO was already established as an organization.
Right.
Element, right now, so.
And what they did was just come in and just man load the staffing plan, the organization we had set up.
Bring the engine office in.
And then bring the engine office in.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know how to assess what Bob Young contributed. I'm sure he contributed some. He was from industry. I don't really know. I don't know what he contributed.
Yeah, I think he contributed something in the sector. I think everybody made it clear that they did not understand.
why did he come down in the first place?
Mr. Webb brought him in.
This was a superimposed decision from headquarters.
The administrator, how about coming back there? You're with one of the potential charges, contractors there.
Did he go back to Aerojet then?
Yeah. Back to the same job.
Yeah. Well, we've covered a lot of ground, skipped back and forth, but I think I've got a little bit better idea about, you know, how that existence office functions a little bit. Anything else you want to add?